The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
The typical way you study malaria vaccines is to randomize people into a vaccine group and a control group and give everybody malaria. You'd put mosquitoes in a cup, put the cup on your arm, and you let the mosquitoes bite you. And the idea is that the people who didn't get the vaccine will get malaria, and the people who did get the vaccine, the hope is they won't get malaria. You can't do that kind of study with COVID-19.
I'm Benjamin Wittes.
And I'm Quinta Jurassic.
And this is the Lawfare Podcast,
April 21st,
2020. There's been a lot of confusion during the COVID-19 crisis about what counts as legitimate clinical evidence that a treatment really works.
The president is endorsing unproven drug therapies based on anecdotal accounts.
And while Lawfare is not a clinical trials or medical site, the subject of treating coronavirus cases certainly has become a national security issue.
We just happen to know two of the perfect people to offer a basic explainer in the clinical research process.
Mom and Dad.
To be precise, Ben's mom and my dad, both of whom are biostatisticians.
My mother, Janet Wittes, is the president of Statistics Collaborative, a company that designs and analyzes data from clinical trials. She used to be the chief of statistics at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute.
My father, Steve Beiske, is a professor of statistics at Rutgers University, who works on biostatistics, statistical genetics, and experimental design.
We invited them into the virtual jungle studio to talk about the history of clinical trials.
The standards for good clinical research.
And to what extent those standards can slip when you're dealing with an ongoing pandemic that's killing people worldwide.
It's the Lawfare Podcast, April 21st.
Mom and Dad talk clinical trials in a pandemic.
So guys, it is Parents Night on the Lawfare Podcast. We have here Steve Beiske, who is the father of one Quinta Jurassic, and we have one Janet Wittes, who is known around the Wittes household as Mom. We're going to get to why you guys are on the podcast in a moment, but I want to start, Steve, with the question of under what circumstances, if any, it is appropriate for a president to get up at a press conference and pronounce on the likely safety and efficacy of a drug in an untested situation?
I think that's a loaded question. a president who's a research physician would be fine, except until you got to the untested part. So the problem is that even understanding why one drug might be useful in this situation is complicated, and it's not the sort of thing that by just having a presidential informal proclamation sort of helps anything at all, and it leads to a lot of difficulties, and weirdly politicizes something that ought to be just a straightforward scientific question.
Mom, I'm going to call you Janet for purposes of this podcast.
Okay.
Can you see any circumstances in which what the president has been doing with hydroxychloroquine is appropriate? How many facts about it do you have to change before it becomes in the world in which you live professionally becomes an appropriate exercise of the bully pulpit.
So I would go further. I think appropriate or inappropriate is too mild a word. I think it is really wrong what he's done. There's very little evidence for the benefit of this drug in COVID-19. The drug has lots of harms, specifically cardiotoxicity. There are different doses of the drug that one can use. To stand up with the bully pulpit that he has and make a pronouncement that this drug should be used, then, and he said, what is there to lose? There's plenty to lose. So I think this was a very bad, irresponsible move that he did.
So the reason that we wanted to have you two on, of course, is not just that you're our parents, although that is, of course, qualification enough, but that your professional work involves work on statistics and on clinical trials. So we wanted to just ask you to sort of explain to listeners what your background is in this area. Dad, I'm going to ask you to go first.
Sure. So my expertise in clinical trials is much smaller than Janet, who's a well-known authority on it. But so I'm a professor at Rutgers, so I teach experimental design. I've designed and analyzed a handful of trials. And so I'm more a sort of statistical handyman than a clinical trial expert.
And Janet, how about you?
So I'm a statistician like Steve, and I've been working in clinical trials actually for close to 40 years. I was at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, and in the group, I led the statistical research group where we were involved in many trials, many large-scale trials of cardiovascular disease, lung disease, and blood diseases. And then for the last 30 years, I've had a small company, and that company, one of the major things we do is work in clinical trials over in a variety of therapeutic areas. So I've been involved in lots of trials, big trials of 25, 35,000 people, tiny trials of 10 to 15 people, and all sizes in between, lots of different diseases. But it's very important. The trials that I deal with are randomized trials, and I think that's important to state up front. There are trials in which a patient comes in or a potential participant in the trial comes in and is assigned through some random process to either an experimental treatment or a control treatment. And those are the kinds of trials I've dealt with.
Okay, so we're going to get to the optimal and suboptimal designs of clinical trials in a minute. But before we do, I just want to ask you, what is the condition in which you have worked on a trial that is most similar to an ongoing global pandemic? I mean, it seems like a highly unusual situation in which to conduct clinical research. I know you've done some malaria studies. What are the worst conditions in which you've ever had to conduct a clinical trial, and how do they match up against this?
Well, even the malaria trials in areas that are what are called holoendemic, which means they're endemic, a huge proportion of the people in the areas have malaria or have been exposed to malaria in the past and therefore have some resistance to it. It's nothing like this. Part of the complexity of this is that clinics can't see patients in the trials because they're seeing patients who have COVID-19. People can't get to the clinics to get their measurements. So I don't know whether Steve's been involved in anything like this, but I certainly have not.
No, but there's one aspect of it that I have seen, which is I was involved in two clinical trials involving behavior for patients with autism. And in both cases, the treatment was something you could buy in a health food store and appeared to not have particularly harmful side effects. So in both cases, about halfway through the trial, sort of there started to be news reports that this might be something that worked. And all of a sudden, we couldn't accrue patients anymore because anybody who was interested would just go to the health food store and put their kid on it. And so that can be an issue when, say, the president says, you know, everybody should take some drug, that people may not want to participate in a study in which they're not certain that they're going to get that drug.
So let's dive in a little bit to the history of clinical trials, because I do think this is an area that a lot of people don't know about, but it's not like this is a hugely new idea. So, Dad, can you just walk through sort of how did we end up at this point of how clinical trials are currently run? When does it start? And what has it looked like over the past, you know, century or so?
So I think the first clinical trial might be counted as testing whether eating lemons helped with scurvy in the 1740s, 50s, something like that. And then the first trials that involved sort of systematic allocation of the participants to the treatments goes back to infectious diseases in both diphtheria and then the plague, actually the other order, in the very late 1800s, early 1900s. But they used, those weren't randomized, but they used what's called an alternate allocation, where every other patient gets the treatment. You alternate between one treatment and the control or another treatment. The first sort of modern randomized clinical trial is, I think it was published in 1948. It included randomization, but it brought together a lot of other sort of good practices, and that had to do with tuberculosis and streptomycin. And Austin Bradford Hill was sort of the driving force behind that. That sort of began the modern era. And then a lot of the history since then has been in sort of improving a lot of things about doing such things, even like consent. The control group in that streptomycin trial didn't know they were involved in an experiment. That wouldn't fly today. Things like a lot of ways of addressing bias, improvements in how to run multi-center trials. And from a statistical point of view, one of the things that's happened in no small part because of Janet's role, which I should have said at the beginning, the very first serious statistical paper I read on clinical trial was co-authored by Janet, which has to do with basically statistical, we can talk about this later, but statistical approaches to make a trial basically run faster, you know, stop using treatments that aren't effective, make sample size bigger if it turns out you're going to need that. Something's sometimes called ethical trials, where you, if one treatment seems to be particularly effective, you start putting more patients on that, things like that. That's mostly been in the last, 30 years now that part's been going on.
So, Janet, when you think about what the gold standard is, so let's just take the president's working hypothesis, which is that hydroxychloroquine is a miracle cure. What would a study look like that would demonstrate that to your satisfaction? If instead of talking about it in the fashion that he had, there had been, you know, a published paper saying we tested hydroxychloroquine as a cure for, or as a treatment for COVID-19 patients in severe respiratory distress. What is a good study of that look like? What are the elements of it?
Well, that's a very good question. The first thing would be, an issue that I talked about before, would be a randomization. So you'd have a number of people, and we'll talk about the sample size in a minute, but a number of people who have certain eligibility requirements. So you would have specify what are the people that should be in the trial. What's their level of illness? What's their age group, perhaps? Are there reasons that they should not be taking a specific drug because they have heart conditions? Who are the people that are being studied? And that should be very clear. And then you'd have a process like a coin toss or a die, allocating the people to a treatment and a control group in a random process. It could be a one-to-one process. It could be two-to-one process. But the process needs to be randomized.
So I want to cut you off right there, because the naive listener here is going to say, wait a minute, you're randomizing people onto no treatment or some kind of control when we have an experimental drug that might save their lives. Why is it ethical to randomize people onto off of the experimental therapy when they've come to a hospital in search of cures? They may die without it, and you're denying on a random basis half the patients the, you know, you're denying them access to a treatment that may save their lives.
Well, the simple answer is it's a treatment that may be harmful. In the absence of knowledge of whether the treatment is helpful or harmful, we don't know. And the only way to know is to do an experiment with a control group. And the only way to do an experiment with a control group is to make sure that the control group and the experimental group are sufficiently similar to each other so that any difference that you see between the groups is due to the treatment, not to chance. Now, if this were a magic treatment, right, where everybody who got it would jump up and be healthy, you don't need randomization. So there are extreme examples where the results are so terrific that there's no variability and you don't need to randomize. But that's those are very unusual cases, and certainly not in this case. The other thing you want to make sure, and this is one of the faults of the studies that have already been done, you want to make sure that you have an outcome that you've defined. It could be clearing of the virus. It could be not dying. It could some outcome, some defined outcome. And you want to make sure that you determine for each person in your study what their outcome was. You don't want a study where a certain percentage of people are missing those data. And you want really reliable data and carefully analyzed. And you want a sample size that is large enough so that if the treatment is effective, the data will show that. And if the treatment is not effective or harmful, the data will show that. Now, there are other things you might ask for in a perfect world. You might ask that the study be blinded. I think in the situation that we're in now, that becomes too complicated. It may be possible, but it may not be. So I think you want to be able to have the main features, clear endpoint, randomization, and as little missing data as possible. Those are what you need to have. And an unbiased assessment of the outcomes.
So turning to the unbiased assessment, one of the things you mentioned, Janet, was the role of blinding. So, Dad, can you talk about what blinding is and why it's important? And then there's another aspect of this, too, which is this question of sample size. I think listeners may have seen that there have been some questions raised about some of the studies about the drug that Trump has promoted and that they're very small studies. So what is sample size and why does it matter?
So to start with blinding, the idea comes about because anybody who's working with these drugs, doing these trials, they want it to succeed. We all want to have some treatments. And so whether consciously or unconsciously, people are going to be, in some sense, trying to sort of help out the treatment to sort of make it succeed. So for instance, if your allocation of patients to treatment or control is not done in a systematic way, such as randomization, then historically people would sort of pick the slightly healthier patients to put on the treatment and the sicker patients to put on the control because that would sort of help the results. You know, they were sure that the treatment worked and they just wanted to make sure that the study showed that, subconsciously or not. Another aspect of that is evaluation. If you're not using a very hard endpoint like death, then you may, you know, you're trying to evaluate whether a patient's improved by this amount. If you know it's a patient on treatment or a patient on control, you may make that may affect your judgment. And then even the analysis when you're doing statistical analysis, depending on how much you have sort of specified in advance, there are a number of decisions that you make as you do that. Is this, if there's an outlier in the lab results, do you include that? Do you throw it away? Do you transformations of the data, just all these sorts of analytic questions that come up. When you're doing the analysis, you might just know group A and group B. If you know which one is treatment and which is control, you may have this subconscious bias to push the results the way that you hope to see them. So switching to sample size. So one of the problems is in you know, if you're bringing somebody back from the dead and you can do that a couple of times, people are going to talk about you for couple thousand years, right? But in you know, infectious diseases, there are very few such cases where like every infected patient's going to die. Even Ebola is not isn't up there. So a certain number of patients are just going to recover anyway. So I looked up the CDC's had a report last week that suggested that the mortality rate for patients who were hospitalized was about 15%. So if you had a drug that changed that 15% to 5%, so you know that's quite an improvement. It's, you know, you're doing three times better. Just to work out how many participants you need in the study to make sure that you have an answer that you can trust, it would be on the order of about 150 on each arm. You have to have enough so that you're not fooled by the phenomenon of, you know, tossing a coin three times and getting heads. But in this case, it's a coin that gives heads 85% of the time. So it's not too surprising that you toss it a bunch of times to see enough heads. So to be able to distinguish between 15% or 5%, you just need a lot of individuals. If you had basically a drug that's a near cure, you'd still need about 50 people in each arm just to be sort of sure that you're not fooling yourself.
All right. So I want to ask about the role of anecdotal data here. You know, the president talks about hydroxychloroquine. It's very promising. And Anthony Fauci responds, you know, there have been some promising accounts, but they're all anecdotal. Obviously, when you're designing a study, you're trying to get away from anecdotal data. You're trying to get to something that's provable and replicable. On the other hand, if you're a doctor in an intensive care unit, there's a lot of tinkering going on, and you have an instinct that X drug may help with the patient in front of you. You use it, the patient improves, and you have no way of knowing whether, to use Steve's example just before, it's one of the 85% who was going to improve anyway, or whether it improved because of that intervention. And so you report that you have had this effect. You may believe that you had this effect. And so from a statistician's perspective, I don't know which of you wants to jump in and answer this, from a statistician's perspective, what is the legitimate role of those experiences? Is it zero? Is it merely that it presents hypotheses that can then be tested? Or is there areas where it is actually legitimate to say, hey, we have this wealth of clinical experience that shows that X has the following effects? Therefore, we may not really need a rigorous clinical trial about it.
So I can jump in here. I think in the cases that we're talking about now, I think these anecdotal data are important. They're important enough that people are saying that looks like these drugs may have benefit and it's worth studying. So it's not just a random choice of a drug. It's a drug where people have tried it. There's some biologic reason that it might work. There are some very clearly known harms. And so it's worth testing. There are anecdotal, there are rare cases where a treatment is so beneficial. You've never seen a cure, and now you do see a cure. Some of the examples of that right now, I think, will be gene therapies, where gene therapies can lead to cures that would would not have happened otherwise. So I think there are some examples of therapies where you don't need controls, but they're few and far between. And I don't know of any, in infectious disease. Even in Ebola, it was really important that those trials were randomized in order to get reliable information quickly so that people could get treatments that worked. Otherwise, we would never know whether things work. We'd never know what dose to use.
Yeah, I want to add a historic example. So there was a trial in the late 80s, early 90s called the Cardiac Arrhythmia Suppression Trial, CAST. And it was basically to see whether if you reduce the arrhythmia, you might reduce the number of heart attacks that people had. And at the time, there were a number of cardiologists were opposed to the trial because they thought it was unethical. The drugs were already approved, but this was sort of a really big study. So cardiologists felt it was unethical because they knew from their personal experience that these drugs were very effective. And the original design of the trial, the original plan, they weren't even going to consider statistically whether the drugs might be harmful. And as it turned out, they were really good at stopping arrhythmia to the extent that they would just stop the heart. So it turned out that sort of everyone's surprised that not only were the drugs not effective, they were actually harmful. And that was not something that people had sort of noticed in their sort of daily use of it. So, you know, that's why you have to have a trial.
So with that sort of under our belts, I think it's a good idea to dig into what it looks like when you're conducting a clinical trial under extreme circumstances where, you know, the disease, as in this case, is, you know, unknown or particularly deadly. I think many of the listeners have probably seen the movie Contagion, where the CDC character conducts a clinical trial by injecting herself with the drug. I think Janet and Steve will probably both agree that that's not something that normally happens. But I would like to talk about, you know, what considerations do go into conducting trials in these sorts of situations. So maybe the way to do this is, Janet, if you could start just by talking about your own experience in designing trials in sort of extreme situations, and then we can move out from there to discussing sort of broader principles.
So I've actually not been involved in studies in this kind of extreme situation. I do want to mention a couple of things about historical things about people injecting themselves with treatments. The typical way you study malaria vaccines is to randomize people into a vaccine group and a control group and give everybody malaria. And then you see whether the people who got the vaccine didn't get malaria. You put mosquitoes in a cup, put the cup on your arm, and you let the mosquitoes bite you. And the idea is that the people who didn't get the vaccine will get malaria, and the people who did get the vaccine, the hope is they won't get malaria. You can't do that kind of study with COVID-19. If we're trying to study a vaccine for COVID-19, you can't randomize people to vaccine. You can't give everybody COVID-19 and see whether the vaccine protects. So that's a kind of an extreme example where you have treatment for the drug when you get the disease. But I think the situation we're in now with a disease that is really awful and puts everybody involved in treatment at risk, this makes clinical trials really hard. And that's why I said early on, I wouldn't bother with blinding. There's certain kinds of parts of a trial that in an ideal situation you would do. But I think here you have to think about, how do I keep the patients as safe as I can, as get them as better as quickly as I can? And how do I keep the health workers safe? And so as you're designing these trials, and there are a lot of them going on with actually thousands of people, that has to be a really very important front and center consideration, that the trials think about what you need in order to make inference, randomization, unbiased collection of outcomes, and clarity of who's in the study, and let the other niceties go. It won't be as clean a study as you would all as you would do in a less dire situation, but the fundamentals you need to keep so that the data at the end are clearly interpretable.
I need to pause over the question of why it is ethical or appropriate to expose an experimental population to malaria. So you have a group of people who are not sick, and you give some of them a vaccine, and you give some of them a placebo, and then you expose them all to malaria. Why is that okay?
Well, these are volunteers. These are volunteers who are given very clear information about what their risk is. And these are people who are willing to take that risk for the benefit of the total population, of the population at large. These studies are done, the ones I've been involved in are done in the Army, and there are volunteers both who are soldiers and also volunteers from the community. This is totally altruistic. The vaccines for flu are done the same way. They're done with what are called challenge trials. So the ethics really, it really is altruism on the part of the participants in these trials and what is ethically necessary. The investigators have to explain exactly what the risks are, and people have to be willing to understand those risks. One of the things that's really important is that they not be paid a lot of money, right, to do these trials. You don't want it to be a profitable thing for them, because that can induce people to take risks that they otherwise would not. I have great respect for people who do this.
So one of the big examples of clinical trials under extreme circumstances with a population that has ended up with a disease but hasn't volunteered for it in recent memory, obviously, is AIDS. And one, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's recently gotten a great deal of press attention and celebrity, was in fact involved in the AIDS response. So Dad or Janet, whichever of you wants to weigh in, can you talk a little bit about sort of the history of conducting trials in a kind of urgent situation and how things have historically gotten waived, perhaps using AIDS as an example that springs out to me because of Fauci's role, but also because I know there were some debates about questions about waiving the use of a control group, allowing people to try multiple therapies at once, that kind of thing.
So I think the AIDS patients were extremely brave, courageous, and scientific. I think it's a lesson in what a community does, how it joined together and said, what we really need are trials that give answers that are correct. And they were the ones, they pushed for randomization, they pushed for large trials. They were very brave and true leaders. And I think that's a very good example going back to what the community did, the HIV community did to ensure and to push for really good trials was extremely important. And if you think about how that disease changed from a universally fatal disease to now a disease that is controlled in basically 30 years, it's pretty remarkable.
So I'll switch to a more recent example, which is Ebola. So the one of the issues in trials, both for vaccines and for treatments, has been that it sort of comes and goes, and so there needed to be both a lot of sort of flexibility and the ability to react quickly to an outbreak happening, not just in the clinical work, but in the sort of research aspect, as well as that the daily interactions are not based at sort of research hospitals in major cities, and one of the things that some of the lessons from that, which I think are very applicable to the to today is that besides the scientific aspects of clinical trials, there are a lot of administrative aspects to protect people to make sure the science sort of works right. There's these administrative aspects can take a lot of time. You know, there's developing a protocol, agreeing on the consents, having the institutional review board approve what you're doing, various other aspects of those. And so in the various Ebola trials, what they were able to do was sort of have a common set of protocols and consents that people had agreed that were basically ready to go, so that when an outbreak happened someplace, they could just pick up with this protocol. When the outbreak died off, if they didn't have enough data, they could sort of suspend things until more data came from another outbreak to sort of prevent this, heads come up five times, that everybody should take this drug sort of aspect. And to sort of anticipate a question you might have had, I think that's one way that you can really speed up trials in a crisis, is to work to make these administrative aspects, which can take months, if not sort of years, to get completely straightened out, to put a lot of effort into just making those go really fast.
Speaking of speed, I want to ask about what we can expect when there is a vaccine candidate. So company X says, we have a vaccine candidate that we have a good laboratory reason to believe will actually have clinical benefit. There is no human testing so far. So what does leaving aside regulatory issues for approval, but just like as a matter of testing, what has to happen before you guys are satisfied that it's safe to inject into people? And that it really, like, how long does it take to do a study? How long do you have to follow how large a population randomized before you say, okay, the people who have gotten the treatment effect, the actual treatment, are doing, in a statistically significant way, better than the people who got randomized off of it?
So I'm going to answer that I don't know the answer to that. What I do know is that right now there are lots and lots of developments of candidate vaccines that are going on. And they're very different from each other. They have very different mechanisms of action, very different biology, but there's quite a number of companies that are developing them right now. What will happen is that they'll inject them into small numbers of people to see whether they're reasonably safe. And I put reasonably safe in quotes. There'll be some definition of what is reasonably safe. I don't know how they will be able to test them, because I just don't know how large a sample size you need. It seems to me it would be pretty large. I don't know who would be the original people getting these vaccines. Would they be people at high risk? I don't know. It's a very different kind of vaccine from any of the vaccines that I've worked with, where you could actually do a long study, very, very large, and count the number of diseases, of events over a period of years. And I don't think we have time for that. So I wish I could give you a better answer, Ben.
Steve, do you have instincts about what the trial looks like for a vaccine and over what time frame?
So let me raise some of the sort of issues that go into that. So one is that just because you have a vaccine that looks like a good candidate really doesn't mean that it's safe. And the level of safety that you might accept for a drug that you're giving to someone in the ICU is very different than what a vaccine you give to healthy people. So we're talking about giving something to millions, if not billions, of people. You don't want the cure worse than the disease. And just two examples. So there is a vaccine that was developed for SARS, and that when it was given to, to primates in testing, it turned out that when they were then sort of challenged with the actual virus, that their immune response was so powerful, it basically killed them. So, that's not the sort of thing we would want to see. And that happens naturally as well. So people who have had dengue fever, if they have a second infection with maybe a slightly different strain, the reaction is often much worse. So it's not a matter of like, is this effective or not? The safety is not something that you can ignore. And it takes time to discern that because we don't really understand right now just how strong the immune response is among patients who have had this, who have had COVID-19. And so there's part of doing the study is it's just inherent that you're going to have to wait at least a few weeks to see, you know, whether people have fully built up a response to a vaccine. And then that carries over when you're doing the study of whether it's effective, because, you know, like the flu vaccine takes, you know, roughly 2 weeks to reach full effectiveness. Maybe these vaccines will, you know, maybe they'll take a month to reach full effectiveness. And so there's a delay that's built in there that's inherent. You just can't make that part go faster. And then that's combined with that you need very large sample sizes because you can't be certain about what kind of exposure people are going to have, which, you know, in turn implies that you need to have production ramped up and things. And you need this sort of administrative support. You can't be just giving people a vaccine and then saying, you know, call us if you get sick. You need to be able to have a systematic way of following them, all of which make things complicated. They take time. And you know, I think people have latched onto that 12 to 18 months as sort of a guarantee of what's going to happen. And that would be great, but it's not certain. I mean, I remember what was Margaret Heckler in the 1980s saying that basically that we'd have a vaccine for HIV in just a few years, which we don't.
So to close, I wanted to ask both of you about something that's been on my mind concerning sort of scientific illiteracy. Sounds too harsh, but I think a lack of understanding on the part of many people, which can be laid at the feet of many things about science, about statistics, about how clinical trials work, you know, that I think I would certainly argue has led to the sheer amount of dis and misinformation out there around COVID-19, which the president is contributing to, that, you know, if someone doesn't know the basic principles of clinical trials that we've been discussing here, it can be difficult to parse why what the president is saying is wrong. And similarly, if someone isn't familiar with, you know, the basics of the kind of math you need to know and understand to look at a graph with a log scale of COVID cases or deaths, that can be hard to understand too. So I guess I'll frame this as a question in sort of in two parts, and you can both choose which part you want to answer. But the first is, to what extent do you think that is genuinely a problem? And the second part is, beyond, you know, recording educational podcasts like this one, is there anything immediate that we can do about it? Or is this going to have to be, is this kind of a sign that we need a long-term public education effort?
So, Quinta, I think this is really, you have hit on a really important problem, not only for clinical trials, but for science in general. There is such a lack of understanding and respect for science among so many people in this country that I don't think there's a quick fix for this at all. I think it has to start teaching in a careful, scientific, intelligent way, elementary school, high school, college. There's no quick fix. When you think of what has happened to the measles vaccine, that people don't believe the measles vaccine is effective, and they haven't vaccinated their children. If you think about sticking with vaccines, the fear of autism from coming from vaccines, from a paper that should never have been published and has been retracted, and yet it gets quoted over and over and over again. So I think there's got to be a very strong effort by states, nationally, to increased scientific and numerical literacy, and that's going to be a long job.
Along those lines, it does seem like it's a lost opportunity that during the task force press conferences not to try to address this sort of every day. I mean, you know, 2 months ago, I thought I knew how to wash my hands, and so I think, you know, lots of people understand that now. People are learning how they're supposed to use face masks. You really could be sort of explaining why we need clinical trials and how they bring us beyond just having anecdotes, because, you know, clinical trials are not obvious why you need to do them. And it's and then the language that people who work in clinical trials, it doesn't necessarily sort of help. I mean, just in this podcast, for instance, we've been talking about, you know, the control group. I'm not sure if we ever made clear that the control group doesn't mean not giving treatment. It means you're giving them standard of care. And so, you know, why is a clinical trial ethical? Why does it give you information that just observation doesn't? They're not trivial concepts. And so it's just in the same way, you know, over and over again, I've seen videos about how to wash your hands. You know, that could be just a steady thing of this is the benefit of doing it this way. This is the benefit of doing this way. This is why we don't think that this drug, it's not that we don't think it's effective. We don't know whether it's effective, because just having, the fact that someone you knew took it and got better doesn't really tell us anything. But, you know, I've been in a quantitative field for 40 years, and I remember people talking about the lack of understanding of quantitative subjects when I was in grad school. It's not going to go away. Well, on the other hand, we now have lots of teaching examples that people from middle school through college are going to be using for a long time, unfortunately.
We're going to leave it there. Janet, it feels weird calling you that. Mom, Steve.
That feels weird to hear my name from you.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us.
Well, my pleasure.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution.
You should do your part to promote the Lawfare podcast.
Tweet us, share us on Facebook, add us to all the Reddit subgroups you haunt.
Pin us on Pinterest.
And don't forget to leave a rating or review wherever you found us.
Our audio engineer this episode was Ian Enright.
The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell.
Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, who's going to be a guest on an upcoming episode of the Lawfare podcast from quarantine in Beijing, having just come back from a reporting trip to Wuhan.
And as always,
thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.